Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Insane, immoral wars, including Obama's hellish adventures in AFPAC, can be ended. Here's what it takes. Soldiers who rebel, and widespread civilian support for those soldiers. What do you think stopped the U.S. rape of Vietnam? The goodness of Richard Nixon's heart? This week and next, we feature the short version of Richard Zeiger's fine film about the GI revolt in Vietnam, Sir, No Sir. I've added a few footnotes to make it work on radio. Let's listen.
In the early 1960s, the United States government began sending combat troops to South Vietnam.
President Lyndon B. Johnson.
If this little nation goes down the drain and can't maintain her independence, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other little nations.
America's stated goal was to spread democracy and defend freedom. But 30 years later, the legacy of that 10-year war, which left 50,000 Americans and over 3 million Vietnamese dead, still remains unsettled. And in the decades of debate that followed the end of the war, some stories have yet to be heard.
Today, your soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardmen are better educated than before, are better informed, have traditional American ingenuity and initiative, are better physical specimens, have high morale, and understand what the war is all about.
You must understand that I like being a Green Beret. I thought it was good.
When I did go in the military, I went in there gung-ho. In basic training, you have this 500 points that you score. I scored like 501 or something. I was really ready.
I tried to spend my whole life having people live a better life and basically feel better. That's what nurses do, right?
They tried to turn me into a killer. They tried to turn me into somebody who would take another life. If there's one thing in my life I feel like that I've accomplished, it's that I didn't allow that to happen.
The president shaped my hand and pinned a medal on me. You can say that was one of the most proudest moments of my life.
You know, it took us almost 3 weeks across the Pacific, and there wasn't too much to do on a troop ship, so we'd sit up on the deck at night and have rats. And a lot of times it would get to what we were going to, whether it was right or wrong. And we'd go back and forth. And we'd always end up concluding, well, let's hope we're doing the right thing because that's where we're going.
During the Vietnam War, an anti-war movement emerged that altered the course of history. This movement didn't take place on college campuses, but in barracks and on ships. It flourished in army stockades, navy brigs, and the dingy towns that surrounded military bases. It penetrated elite military colleges like West Point, and it spread throughout the battlefields of Vietnam. It was a movement no one expected, least of all those in it. Hundreds went to prison and thousands into exile, and by 1971 it had, in the words of one colonel, infested the entire armed services. Yet today, few people know about the GI movement against the war in Vietnam.
I was really proud of what I thought I was doing.
The earliest days of the war planted the seeds for the movement to come, even among the first American troops in Vietnam, the elite Green Berets.
Former Army Special Forces Green Beret Sergeant Donald Duncan.
The problem I had was realizing that what I was doing was not good. I was doing it right, but I wasn't doing right.
Dr. Howard Levy, who was court-martialed and spent 3 years in the stockade for refusing to prostitute the practice of medicine.
I was asked to train Green Beret people, Special Forces men. Why were they training these guys in dermatology? Well, they were training them to do dermatology in Vietnam because they knew that if they were able to offer a few simple remedies and help cure a few children of some simple bacterial infections, that would ingratiate themselves to the Vietnamese community. And, you know, you remember the phrase, the winning the hearts and minds of the people. So this was how you were going to win the hearts and minds of the people. And while they were offering the band-aids of helping to cure a few cases of impetigo, they were bombing the hell out of the villages.
ARVN is an acronym for Army of the Republic of Vietnam, America's Allies.
I was out on a patrol near Hiep Hòa, and we took a couple of prisoners. Whether they were combatants or not, who knows? The patrol was led by Americans, but there were Vietnamese ARVN there, and they were turned over to ARVN, and ARVN used the old-fashioned methods of interrogation, force, torture. That was pretty common practice. I tell you, as bad as that treatment was, the cynicism that attached to it was the part that was really sickening, I thought. And after that, everything I've been taught, everything I learned, everything I grew up with, this is just not the way you treat human beings. And it was all done for the good of the cause, I guess. I got out of the military in 1966. I got out because of the things I saw, the things I was doing, and the reasons that we were given for doing them. It was a personal protest. It was just me getting out of the service. There was no movement to join.
I found the war in Vietnam more and more repulsive, and I felt that I just couldn't be a part of it. Eventually, I said, look, I'm not training you guys anymore. I don't agree with what you're doing. I think it's immoral. I think it's medically unethical. And I just stopped, threw him out of the clinic. It took a few weeks for the Army to catch up with that. And when they did, they invited me into the commanding officer's office and said, look, what are you doing here? And I told them exactly what I was doing. I said, I'm not training him. And they said, well, you know, you should know the consequences of that. And I said, I'm perfectly aware of the consequences of it. I'm not training him. At that point, it was obvious that I was going to be court-martialed. And a few days later, I got the court-martial notice.
Howard Levy spent 3 years in prison. Along with him, three GIs at Fort Hood who refused orders to Vietnam and received 5 years hard labor and a dishonorable discharge. Army Lieutenant Henry Howe, who carried a sign at a demonstration reading, N. Johnson's Fascist Aggression in Vietnam, was sentenced to 2 years. And two Marines, William Harvey and George Daniel, received 6 to 10 year sentences for organizing a meeting about whether black people should fight in Vietnam. And on March 3, 1966, former Green Beret Donald Duncan was the featured speaker at an anti-war meeting at the Town Hall in Manhattan.
I just wanted to do what I knew about it and let people then judge for themselves.
I think the most startling thing to me occurred, however, as the court-martial began. What would happen was we would walk from the parking lot to the building where the court-martial was being held. And it was the most remarkable thing when hundreds of GIs would hang out of windows, out of the barracks, and give me the V sign, or give me the clenched fist. This was mind-boggling to me. This was a revelation. And at that point, it really became crystal clear to me that something had changed here, and that something very, very important was happening.
How many people in the Army would you think feel the same way, perhaps, as you do are against the war?
I really don't know how many, but I know how many I met, and that was a majority of the men that I met in the service were opposed, but really didn't know how to voice their opinion.
Have you given much thought to the penalty of being AWOL?
Yes.
1968 was the turning point. By then, America had over 500,000 troops in South Vietnam. But during the Lunar New Year holiday called Tet, the enemy, the North Vietnamese and National Liberation Front armies, launched an offensive that overran the entire country before being pushed back. The Tet Offensive revealed that the enemy had widespread support from the Vietnamese people, and America was mired in a war it couldn't win. And with soldiers beginning to question the war in the wake of the Tet Offensive, thousands began going AWOL or absent without leave. Many found their way to San Francisco, where a series of events brought the emerging GI anti-war movement onto the national stage.
We joined together in July 1968.
We took sanctuary in a church and chained ourselves to ministers. We essentially called the press and said to them, we're not going to Vietnam. we're refusing our orders, and in fact we're resigning from the military to come and get us. The fact that it took them 3 days to decide how to deal with this tactically, that was great.
They had nothing to lose. And it had no idea what was going to come. And that's a free place. It's a really free place, you know. You don't know what's going to happen, you know where you're going, but you know what you're doing.
And that was my introduction to the San Francisco Presidio Stockade. The population fluctuated, usually upwards. It was built, I think, and could hold like maybe 60, and there was sometimes double that in there. Overcrowded, toilets backed up, food was short, guards were mean. That wasn't any fun.
With the 9 for peace held in military prisons, soldiers throughout the Bay Area began planning for the first anti-war demonstration in the country organized by GIs and veterans.
Former Navy nurse and lieutenant Susan Schnall.
I was a member of the Medical Committee for Human Rights. We got together a number of times and talked about how we were going to organize active duty GIs to go to the peace demonstration. And then I remember also hearing about the B-52 bombers that were dropping leaflets on Vietnam, urging the Vietnamese to defect. And I thought, well, if they can do it overseas, then we can hire a small private plane, load it up with leaflets, and drop the leaflets on military bases in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thousands and thousands of leaflets. At one point, I know we were a little concerned about getting shot down, but nothing happened. Evidently, they landed pretty accurately. That's what they testified at the court-martial. And on my way driving into the demonstration, I decided I was going to wear my naval uniform. And my opinion was fairly straightforward. It was if Westmoreland could wear his uniform, being for the war and talking in front of Congress, then as an active duty person, I certainly had the same rights that he did, and I could wear my uniform protesting the United States' involvement in Vietnam.
Susan Schnall was court-martialed by the Navy for making a political statement while in uniform. And following the march, 4 AWOL GIs turned themselves into the Presidio Army Stockade, where Keith Mather was being held.
Randy Roland.
So I'd been assigned kind of by the movement people to go into the stockade and find out what was going on because they had shot this prisoner and killed him.
For 19-year-old Private Michael Bunch, life in the Army had been little more than a series of AWOL violations. His last stop was here, the Presidio Stockade, where he was fatally shot last Friday while trying to escape from a work detail.
But the guard shot him and killed him, you know, point blank, and his only crime was not wanting to be there and going AWOL. And he was cut down at a real young age, and for no good reason, not unlike a lot of his brothers in Vietnam, you know. So we reacted viscerally and with anger and disgust and outrage. We tore that jail apart. We ripped the wires out of the walls. We ripped the squawk box off the wall. And then things started to calm down because we started to plan. We came to a decision that the best thing we could do was to have some kind of a demonstration.
And it was at the roll call formation. We had a signal, and that was when we were supposed to break ranks, and we did. And then we walked over here and sat down. At a certain point, Commandant came out and read us the Mutiny Act, and we just kept singing louder and, you know, kind of linked arms and singing.
We were scared, man. I'll tell you, we were really scared. But we had them right where we want them. They were finally listening to us, man. That's the first time I can ever remember anybody listening to us while I was in the military.
The commanding general of the 6th Army, which was the jurisdiction, he said that they thought that the revolution was about to start and that they really had to set an example, you know, come down hard, and we were the guys that they decided to do that with. And they did. I mean, you know, we were on trial for our life. You know, I kind of came in as an AWOL, and, you know, within 2 days of hitting the stockade, I was, I was facing the death sentence for saying that we shall overcome. We'll be right back.
nationwide support for the Presidio 27 grew, the GI movement had arrived.
Former Army soldier Dave Klein.
I was wounded three times while I was in out in the bush. And then the third time I was wounded was on December 20th, 67. And we got overrun by North Vietnamese regulars. They started like a human wave attack. And the guy came up behind our hole and stuck his rifle in the hole. And I saw the front sight of an AK-47 and a muzzle flash. And I had my M16 pointed up and I started pulled my trigger when I saw the AK sight. And a bullet hit me in the knee and I blacked out. I came to a few minutes later and my gun was jammed and my knee was shattered. After the fighting ended and the sun came up and they carried me over to this guy who had shot me. And he was sitting up against a tree stump and he was dead. He had three bullet holes up his chest and he had his AK laying across his lap. And the sergeant said, "Here's this gook you killed, you did a good job." And I seen this guy and he was about my age. And I started thinking, you know, why is he dead and I'm alive? It was just a matter of pure luck. Then I started thinking, I wonder if he had a girlfriend and if his, how his mother's going to find out and things like that. He says, when you just went through an experience of that nature and you find out that it's all lies and that they're just lying to the American people and your silence means that you're part of keeping that lie going, I couldn't stop. I mean, I couldn't be silent. You know, I felt I had a responsibility to my friends and to the country in general and to the Vietnamese. The last guy who I shot, and I don't consider he was the first guy I shot, but it was the first guy I shot where I was shooting it out barrel to barrel with him and looked him in the face afterwards. And I felt a certain amount of responsibility to him to make that his life, if his death not be in vain, meant that I had to try and advocate for the justice that he was fighting for, because I believed he was fighting for his country. So I became involved in the movement. That's what happened with me.
With more and more soldiers turning against the war, a handful of peace activists opened the first of what would become a network of dozens of anti-war GI coffee houses located in the towns that hover near military bases. The dusty Texas town of Killeen, just outside Fort Hood, which housed over 20,000 troops, became home of a GI coffee house known as the Oleo Strut.
Being in the Army, I can get over here and I can sit down and write poetry and I can sit here and listen and I can get them in the Army for about 15 minutes to an hour or something like this.
The name Oleo Strut came from a shock absorber on a helicopter. So that's what the Oleo Strut was, and it was a place where you go there and they sold sodas and they had a record player and all the latest rock records and underground papers and just hang out and rap.
In a coffee house, a young soldier tells young civilians about the reality of the war he fought.
And they go out on ambushes. Like for a 1 month period, we go out on ambushes and we kill over 50 people, you know, in the early hours of the morning. And you start looking at bodies because they've got to get their body count. And who's there? Well, the majority were women and children. And what were they doing? What was their crime? They were carrying food. They were carrying food to their, you know, their friends up in the hills. For anyone who thinks he can duck out of it and hopefully be a Kirk typist and not have to see any of that, he's making a mistake because he's supporting the war.
A new phenomenon has cropped up at several Army bases these days, a so-called underground GI press, which consists largely of anti-war newspapers. Military authorities are clamping down hard on the papers. Recently, it was announced
there was an underground newspaper laying on the bed, and it was called The Last Harass. They freaked out, man. They were freaking out. This is unauthorized material, and this is subversive material. You're not allowed to have any copies of this inside the barracks. You got to turn this in immediately. That night, then, the paper then went around in the barracks. Everybody's reading it, two or three guys at a time sitting around on a bed, around guys' beds and stuff like that, checking out this paper. What I liked about it was the fact that the officers hated it. To me,
It had to be good.
It had to be good. It had to be something about this that was good.
Typed, mimeographed, printed, the GI Underground Press exploded.
Fort Knox, Kentucky.
One travel and adventure.
Fort Gordon, Georgia.
Fort Benning, Georgia.
Chanute Air Force Base.
Four-year bomber.
Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Shakedown.
Fort Hood, Texas.
Fatigue Press is published by a group of radical soldiers stationed at this Army base.
And we used to distribute it clandestinely on base. We'd go around and leave bunches of them in barracks. We'd go through barracks at night and leave them on foot lockers. And if you were caught distributing literature on base, that was a court-martial offense.
Shortly after the first issue was published, the GI who founded the Fatigue Press, Gypsy Peterson, was pulled over by Fort Hood police.
And they vacuumed out his car and claimed to found remnants of marijuana and arrested him for possession of marijuana in an attempt to suppress his movement.
Following a two-day trial in a Texas court, Gypsy Peterson was sentenced to 8 years in prison.
Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Briefs.
Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Short times.
Galva, Virginia.
West Germany.
Despite the military's best efforts, the underground press became the lifeblood of the GI movement, as the Army's own recruiting slogan, "Fun, travel, and adventure," turned into the popular GI expression, "F*** the Army." The press linked soldiers around the world and inspired many outside the military.
Actress and activist Jane Fonda.
You know, I grew up believing that if our flag was flying over a battlefield, that we were on the side of the angels. My father fought in the Second World War. He won awards and medals. And, you know, I grew up during the good wars.
Here's this woman who steps out onto the world stage as a famous actress, comes from one of the ruling class families in Hollywood, and makes a political decision to change sides. She steps onto the side of the people, and particularly the Vietnamese people. She stands with the GIs, and she stands with the GI movement, and she says, I'm going to stand with this, I'm going to give vent, I'm going to help support it and build it, and, you know, et cetera, like that, in the FTA show.
Mr. President, there's a terrible demonstration going on outside.
Oh, there's always a demonstration going on outside, Pat.
Yeah, but Richard, this one is completely out of control.
What are they asking for this time?
Free Angela Davis and all political prisoners, out of Vietnam now, and draft all government officials.
Well, we have people to take care of that. They'll do their job, you do your job, and I'll do my job.
But Richard, you don't understand. They're storming the White House.
Oh, in that case, I better call out the Third Marines.
You can't, Richard.
Why not?
It is the Third Marine.
Oh.
For years, pro-war comedian Bob Hope had toured Vietnam entertaining American troops. But soon the cheers turned to jeers, and a new kind of entertainment emerged.
Howard Levy, himself a celebrity within the GI movement, he met with Donald Sutherland and me, and he said, what if we put together an anti-war show that's, you know, the opposite side of the coin from the Bob Hope show?
I went down to that base, they took one look at my face, and read out an order to bar me. I said, Foxtrot, Tango, Alpha, free the Army.
F the Army. We always said, free the Army, or fun travel and adventure, but it really meant the Army.
So we said, Foxtrot, Tango, Alpha, clear.
Here was a way that I could combine my profession, my acting, with my desire to end the war. It just seemed like a perfect fit. The show that we bring to these bases is not trying to tell the people on the bases anything that they don't know. We are coming in response to what is probably the most powerful movement going on in this country, the movement of the men inside the military and women who are beginning to understand how they're being used and what the nature of American foreign policy is. And we come there because they have asked us to. We come there because for the last year we have read in the newspapers from Vietnam, from West Germany, from Okinawa, from the Philippines, from Japan. What we want is entertainment. We want people who speak to how we feel. And the majority of us don't know why we're going over there. We don't know why we're being shot up. We don't know why our buddies are being killed. We don't know why we're killing those people.
I've seen Charlie, Luke the Goof, whatever you want to call him, NVA. Right there laying down as I walk by. I looked at him, he looks at me. Could go on by my business. This man didn't do me nothing. He ain't hurt me in no type of way. He ain't hurt none of my black people, none of my families. So why should I shoot him?
I feel all black men should be exempt from military duty anyway. Because,
The only place
a black man should fight where he's being oppressed. And I'm not being oppressed in Japan, I'm not being oppressed in Vietnam, and I'm not being oppressed in Pakistan.
Guys were coming from all over the country.
So you're getting people coming in with different information about black power struggle at that time and, you know, black unity and, you know, feeling real good about yourself. And you began to really question what you were doing in Vietnam. But I remember one day the first sergeant was talking about gooks. Show you how naive I was. I didn't know that gook was a racial slur. I didn't really understand that. You know, one day he was talking about gooks, and I remember a light went off in my head, and I said, wow, a gook is the same thing as a nigger. Things began to start clicking in my head, like, what am I doing over here?
And with those striking words by Black American vet Greg Payton, let's call a halt to the first half of David Zeiger's great documentary, Sir, No Sir. Thanks to the British Broadcasting Corporation for helping to fund the film and for airing, at least in the UK, this condensed 50-minute version that I've adapted to radio. No thanks at all to the chicken warmongers and corporate suck-ups who have turned America's own public broadcasting system into the best little whorehouse in Washington, D.C. Wait, that's not fair, and I apologize for that gratuitous slur. I apologize to America's hardworking and underappreciated sex workers who, God knows, have done more good for the world and considerably less harm than all the military-industrial corporate stooges and lackeys at the head of our alleged public broadcast system. Gratuitously insulted ladies of the evening and all others will find my email address, our broadcast schedule, photos, great links. To make a long story short, you can get anything you want, Sepinalis, at New World Notes' website, http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from that beacon of light in darkest West Hartford, the University of Hartford. I am Kenneth Doust, pleading with you, illegitimi non carborundum. Keep the change, turn off the lies, turn off the propaganda, turn off the TV set, and please tune in again next week. Let's go out with some appropriate period music. Ciao!